as well as industrial, financial, and business capital, other than a few individual plots of land and small cooperatives. The Soviet government simultaneously eliminated all private returns on capital. The prohibition of usury thus became general. The rate of exploitation, which for Marx represented the share of output appropriated by the capitalist, thus fell to zero, and with it the rate of private return. With zero return on capital, man, or the worker, finally threw off his chains along with the yoke of accumulated wealth. The present reasserted its rights over the past. The inequality, R is greater than G, was nothing but a bad memory, especially since communism vaunted its affection for growth and technological progress. Unfortunately for the people caught up in these totalitarian experiments, the problem was that private property and the market economy do not serve solely to ensure the domination of capital over those who have nothing to sell but their labor power. They also play a useful role in coordinating the actions of millions of individuals, and it is not so easy to do without them. The human disasters caused by Soviet-style centralized planning illustrate this quite clearly. A tax on capital would be a less violent and more efficient response to the eternal problem of private capital and its return. A progressive levy on individual wealth would reassert control over capitalism in the name of the general interest while relying on the forces of private property and competition. Each type of capital would be taxed in the same way, with no discrimination a priori, in keeping with the principle that investors are generally in a better position than the government to decide what to invest in. If necessary, the tax can be quite steeply progressive on very large fortunes, but this is a matter for democratic debate under a government of laws. A capital tax is the most appropriate response to the inequality, R is greater than G, as well as to the inequality of returns to capital as a function of the size of the initial stake. In this form, the tax on capital is a new idea, designed explicitly for the globalized patrimonial capitalism of the 21st century. To be sure, capital in the form of land has been taxed since time immemorial. But property is generally taxed at a low flat rate. The main purpose of the property tax is to guarantee property rights by requiring registration of titles. It is certainly not to redistribute wealth. The English, American, and French revolutions all conformed to this logic. The tax systems they put in place were in no way intended to reduce inequalities of wealth. During the French Revolution, the idea of progressive taxation was the subject of lively debate, but in the end, the principle of progressivity was rejected. What is more, the boldest tax proposals of that time seem quite moderate today in the sense that the proposed tax rates were quite low. The progressive tax revolution had to await the 20th century and the period between the two world wars. It occurred in the midst of chaos and came primarily in the form of progressive taxes on income and inheritances. To be sure, some countries, most notably Germany and Sweden, established an annual progressive tax on capital as early as the late 19th century, or early 20th. But the United States, Britain, and France, until the 1980s, did not move in this direction. Furthermore, in the countries that did tax capital, the rates were relatively low, no doubt because these taxes were designed in a context very different from that which exists today. These taxes also suffered from a fundamental technical flaw. They were based not on the market value of the assets subject to taxation, to be revised annually, but on infrequently revised assessments of their value by the tax authorities. These assessed valuations eventually lost all connection with market values, which quickly rendered the taxes useless. The same flaw undermined the property tax in France and many other countries subsequent to the inflationary shock of the period 1914 to 1945. Such a design flaw can be fatal to a progressive tax on capital. The threshold for each tax bracket depends on more or less arbitrary factors, such as the date of the last property assessment in a given town or neighborhood. Challenges to such arbitrary taxation became increasingly common after 1960, in a period of rapidly rising real estate and stock prices. Often the courts became involved to rule on violations of the principle of equal taxation. Germany and Sweden abolished their annual taxes on capital in 1990 to 2010. This had more to do with the archaic design of these taxes, which went back to the 19th century, than with any response to tax competition. The current wealth tax in France, the Impôt de Solidarité sur la Fortune, or ISF, is in some ways more modern. It is based on the market value of various types of assets, reevaluated annually. This is because the tax was created relatively recently. It was introduced in the 1980s, at a time when inflation, especially in asset prices, could not be ignored. There are perhaps advantages to being at odds with the rest of the developed world in regard to economic policy. In some cases, it allows a country to be ahead of its time. Although the French ISF is based on market values, in which respect it resembles the ideal capital tax, it is nevertheless quite different from the ideal in other respects. As noted earlier, it is riddled with exemptions and based on self-declared asset holdings. In 2012, Italy introduced a rather strange wealth tax, which illustrates the limits of what a single country can do on its own in the current climate. The Spanish case is also interesting. The Spanish wealth tax, like the now defunct Swedish and German ones, is based on more or less arbitrary assessments of real estate and other assets. Collection of the tax was suspended in 2008 to 2010, then restored in 2011-2012 in the midst of an acute budget crisis, but without modifications to its structure. Similar tensions exist almost everywhere. Although a capital tax seems logical in view of growing government needs, as large private fortunes increase and incomes stagnate, a government would have to be blind to pass up such a tempting source of revenue, no matter what party is in power. It is difficult to design such a tax properly within a single country. To sum up, the capital tax is a new idea, which needs to be adapted to the globalized patrimonial capitalism of the 21st century. The designers of the tax must consider what tax schedule is appropriate, how the value of taxable assets should be assessed, and how information about asset ownership should be supplied automatically by banks and shared internationally, so that the tax authorities need not rely on taxpayers to declare their own asset holdings. Alternative forms of regulation, protectionism, and capital controls. Is there no alternative to the capital tax? No, there are other ways to regulate patrimonial capitalism in the 21st century, and some of these are already being tried in various parts of the world. Nevertheless, these alternative forms of regulation are less satisfactory than the capital tax, and sometimes create more problems than they solve. As noted, the simplest way for a government to reclaim a measure of economic and financial sovereignty is to resort to protectionism and controls on capital. Protectionism is at times a useful way of sheltering relatively undeveloped sectors of a country's economy, until domestic firms are ready to face international competition. It is also a valuable weapon against countries that do not respect the rules of financial transparency, health norms, human rights, etc. And it would be foolish for a country to rule out its potential use. Nevertheless, protectionism, when deployed on a large scale over a long period of time, is not in itself a source of prosperity or a creator of wealth. Historical experience suggests that a country that chooses this road, while promising its people a robust improvement in their standard of living, is likely to meet with serious disappointment. Furthermore, protectionism does nothing to counter the inequality R is greater than G, or the tendency for wealth to accumulate in fewer and fewer hands. The question of capital controls is another matter. Since the 1980s, governments in most wealthy countries have advocated complete and absolute liberalization of capital flows, with no controls and no sharing of information about asset ownership among nations. International organizations, such as the OECD, the World Bank, and the IMF, promoted the same set of measures in the name of the latest in economic science. But the movement was propelled essentially by democratically elected governments, reflecting the dominant ideas of a particular historical moment marked by the fall of the Soviet Union, and unlimited faith in capitalism and self-regulating markets. Since the financial crisis of 2008, serious doubts about the wisdom of this approach have arisen, and it is quite likely that the rich countries will have increasing recourse to capital controls in the decades ahead. The emerging world has shown the way, starting in the aftermath of the Asian financial crisis of 1998, which convinced many countries, including Indonesia, Brazil, and Russia, that the policies and shock therapies dictated by the international community were not always well advised, and the time had come to set their own courses. The crisis also encouraged some countries to amass excessive reserves of foreign exchange. This may not be the optimal response to global economic instability, but it has the virtue of allowing single countries to cope with economic shocks without forfeiting their sovereignty. The mystery of Chinese capital regulation. It is important to recognize that some countries have always enforced capital controls and remained untouched by the stampede toward complete deregulation of financial flows and current accounts. A notable example of such a country is China, whose currency has never been convertible, though it may be someday when China is convinced that it has accumulated sufficient reserves to bury any speculator who bets against the renminbi. China has also imposed strict controls on both incoming capital. No one can invest in or purchase a large Chinese firm without authorization from the government, which is generally granted only if the foreign investor is content to take a minority stake, and outgoing capital. No assets can be removed from China without government approval. The issue of outgoing capital is currently quite a sensitive one in China and is at the heart of the Chinese model of capital regulation. This raises a very simple question. Are China's millionaires and billionaires, whose names are increasingly prevalent in global wealth rankings, truly the owners of their wealth? Can they, for example, take their money out of China if they wish? Although the answers to these questions are shrouded in mystery, there is no doubt that the Chinese notion of property rights is different from the European or American notions. It depends on a complex and evolving set of rights and duties. To take one example, a Chinese billionaire who acquired a 20% stake in Telecom China and who wished to move to Switzerland with his family while holding on to his shares and collecting millions of euros in dividends would very likely have a much harder time doing so than, say, a Russian oligarch, to judge by the fact that vast sums commonly leave Russia for suspect destinations. One never sees this in China, at least for now. In Russia, to be sure, an oligarch must take care not to tangle with the president, which can land him in prison. But if he can avoid such trouble, he can apparently live quite well on wealth derived from exploitation of Russia's natural resources. In China, things seem to be controlled more tightly. That is one of many reasons why the kinds of comparisons that one reads frequently in the Western press between the fortunes of wealthy Chinese political leaders and their U.S. counterparts, who are said to be far less wealthy, probably cannot withstand close scrutiny. It is not my intention to defend China's system of capital regulation, which is extremely opaque and probably unstable. Nevertheless, capital controls are one way of regulating and containing the dynamics of wealth inequality. Furthermore, China has a more progressive income tax than Russia, which adopted a flat tax in the 1990s, like most countries in the former Soviet bloc, though it is still not progressive enough. The revenues it brings in are invested in education, health, and infrastructure on a far larger scale than in other emerging countries, such as India, which China has clearly outdistanced. If China wishes, and above all, if its elites agree to allow the kind of democratic transparency and government of laws that go hand in hand with a modern tax system, by no means a certainty, then China is clearly large enough to impose the kind of progressive tax on income and capital that I have been discussing. In some respects, it is better equipped to meet these challenges than Europe is, because Europe must contend with political fragmentation and with a particularly intense form of tax competition, which may be with us for some time to come. In any case, if the European countries do not join together to regulate capital cooperatively and effectively, individual countries are highly likely to impose their own controls and national preferences. Indeed, this has already begun, with the sometimes irrational promotion of national champions and domestic stockholders on the frequently illusory premise that they can be more easily controlled than foreign stockholders. In this respect, China has a clear advantage and will be difficult to beat. The capital tax is the liberal form of capital control and is better suited to Europe's comparative advantage. The redistribution of petroleum rents. When it comes to regulating global capitalism and the inequalities it generates, the geographic distribution of natural resources, and especially of petroleum rents, constitutes a special problem. International inequalities of wealth and national destinies are determined by the way borders were drawn, in many cases, quite arbitrarily. If the world were a single global democratic community, an ideal capital tax would redistribute petroleum rents in an equitable manner. National laws sometimes do this by declaring natural resources to be common property. Such laws, of course, vary from country to country. It is to be hoped that democratic deliberation will point in the right direction. For example, if tomorrow someone were to find in her backyard a treasure greater than all of her country's existing wealth combined, it is likely that a way would be found to amend the law to share that wealth in a reasonable manner. Or so one hopes. Since the world is not a single democratic community, however, the redistribution of natural resources is often decided in far less peaceful ways. In 1990 to 1991, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, another fateful event took place. Iraq, a country of 35 million people, decided to invade its tiny neighbor, Kuwait, with barely 1 million people, but in possession of petroleum reserves virtually equal to those of Iraq. This was in part a geographical accident, of course, but it was also the result of a stroke of the post-colonial pen. Western oil companies and their governments, in some cases, found it easier to do business with countries without too many people living in them, although the long-term wisdom of such a choice may be doubted. In any case, the Western powers and their allies immediately sent some 900,000 troops to restore the Kuwaitis as the sole legitimate owners of their oil fields. Proof, if proof were needed, that governments can mobilize impressive resources to enforce their decisions when they choose to do so. This happened in 1991. The first Gulf War was followed by a second in 2003 in Iraq with a somewhat sparser coalition of Western powers. The consequences of these events are still with us today. It is not up to me to calculate the optimal schedule for the tax on petroleum capital that would ideally exist in a global political community based on social justice and utility, or even in a Middle Eastern political community. I observe simply that the unequal distribution of wealth in this region has attained unprecedented levels of injustice, which would surely have ceased to exist long ago were it not for foreign military protection. In 2012, the total budget of the Egyptian Ministry of Education for all primary, middle, and secondary schools and universities in a country of 85 million was less than $5 billion. A few hundred kilometers to the east, Saudi Arabia and its 20 million citizens enjoyed oil revenues of $300 billion, while Qatar and its 300,000 Qataris take in more than $100 billion annually. Meanwhile, the international community wonders if it ought to extend a loan of a few billion dollars to Egypt, or wait until the country increases, as promised, its tax on carbonated drinks and cigarettes. Surely the international norm should be to prevent redistribution of wealth by force of arms insofar as it is possible to do so, particularly when the intention of the invader is to buy more arms, not to build schools, as was the case with the Iraqi invader in 1991. But such a norm should carry with it the obligation to find other ways to achieve a more just distribution of petroleum rents, be it by way of sanctions, taxes, or foreign aid, in order to give countries without oil the opportunity to develop. Redistribution through immigration. A seemingly more peaceful form of redistribution and regulation of global wealth inequality is immigration. Rather than move capital, which poses all sorts of difficulties, it is sometimes simpler to allow labor to move to places where wages are higher. This was, of course, the great contribution of the United States to global redistribution. The country grew from a population of barely 3 million at the time of the Revolutionary War to more than 300 million today, largely thanks to successive waves of immigration. That is why the United States is still a long way from becoming the new old Europe, as I speculated it might in Chapter 14. Immigration is the mortar that holds the United States together, the stabilizing force that prevents accumulated capital from acquiring the importance it has in Europe. It is also the force that makes the increasingly large inequalities of labor income in the United States politically and socially bearable. For a fair proportion of Americans in the bottom 50% of the income distribution, these inequalities are of secondary importance for the very simple reason that they were born in a less wealthy country and see themselves as being on an upward trajectory. Note, moreover, that the mechanism of redistribution through immigration, which enables individuals born in poor countries to improve their lot by moving to a rich country, has lately been an important factor in Europe as well as the United States. In this respect, the distinction between the old world and the new may be less salient than in the past. It bears emphasizing, however, that redistribution through immigration, as desirable as it may be, resolves only part of the problem of inequality. Even after average per capita output and income are equalized between countries by way of immigration, and even more by poor countries catching up with rich ones in terms of productivity, the problem of inequality, and in particular the dynamics of global wealth concentration, remains. Redistribution through immigration postpones the problem, but does not dispense with the need for a new type of regulation, a social state with progressive taxes on income and capital. One might hope, moreover, that immigration will be more readily accepted by the less advantaged members of the wealthier societies if such institutions are in place to ensure that the economic benefits of globalization are shared by everyone. If you have free trade and free circulation of capital and people but destroy the social state and all forms of progressive taxation, the temptations of defensive nationalism and identity politics will very likely grow stronger than ever in both Europe and the United States. Note, finally, that the less developed countries will be among the primary beneficiaries of a more just and transparent international tax system. In Africa, the outflow of capital has always exceeded the inflow of foreign aid by a wide margin. It is no doubt a good thing that several wealthy countries have launched judicial proceedings against former African leaders who fled their countries with ill-gotten gains. But it would be even more useful to establish international fiscal cooperation and data sharing to enable countries in Africa and elsewhere to root out such pillage in a more systematic and methodical fashion, especially since foreign companies and stockholders of all nationalities are at least as guilty as unscrupulous African elites. Once again, financial transparency and a progressive global tax on capital are the right answers. Chapter 16. The Question of the Public Debt. There are two main ways for a government to finance its expenses: taxes and debt. In general, taxation is by far preferable to debt in terms of justice and efficiency. The problem with debt is that it usually has to be repaid, so that debt financing is in the interest of those who have the means to lend to the government. From the standpoint of the general interest, it is normally preferable to tax the wealthy rather than borrow from them. There are nevertheless many reasons, both good and bad, why governments sometimes resort to borrowing and to accumulating debt, if they do not inherit it from previous governments. At the moment, the rich countries of the world are enmeshed in a seemingly interminable debt crisis. To be sure, history offers examples of even higher public debt levels, as we saw in Part 2. In Britain, in particular, public debt twice exceeded 2 years of national income. First, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and again after World War II. Still, with public debt in the rich countries now averaging about 1 year of national income, or 90% of GDP, the developed world is currently indebted at a level not seen since 1945. Although the emerging economies are poorer than the rich ones in both income and capital, their public debt is much lower, around 30% of GDP on average. This shows that the question of public debt is a question of the distribution of wealth between public and private actors in particular, and not a question of absolute wealth. The rich world is rich, but the governments of the rich world are poor. Europe is the most extreme case. It has both the highest level of private wealth in the world and the greatest difficulty in resolving its public debt crisis. A strange paradox. I begin by examining various ways of dealing with high public debt levels. This will lead to an analysis of how central banks regulate and redistribute capital, and why European unification, overly focused as it was on the issue of currency while neglecting taxation and debt, has led to an impasse. Finally, I will explore the optimal accumulation of public capital and its relation to private capital in the probable 21st century context of low growth and potential degradation of natural capital. Reducing public debt, tax on capital, inflation, and austerity. How can a public debt as large as today's European debt be significantly reduced? There are three main methods, which can be combined in various proportions: taxes on capital, inflation, and austerity. An exceptional tax on private capital is the most just and efficient solution. Failing that, inflation can play a useful role. Historically, that is how most large public debts have been dealt with. The worst solution in terms of both justice and efficiency is a prolonged dose of austerity. Yet, that is the course Europe is currently following. I begin by recalling the structure of national wealth in Europe today. As I showed in Part 2, national wealth in most European countries is close to 6 years of national income, and most of it is owned by private agents, households. The total value of public assets is approximately equal to the total public debt, about 1 year of national income. So net public wealth is close to zero. Private wealth, net of debt, can be divided into two roughly equal halves: real estate and financial assets. Europe's average net asset position vis-à-vis the rest of the world is close to equilibrium, which means that European firms and sovereign debt are owned by European households. Or, more precisely, what the rest of the world owns of Europe is compensated by what Europeans own of the rest of the world. This reality is obscured by the complexity of the system of financial intermediation. People deposit their savings in a bank or invest in a financial product, and the bank then invests the money elsewhere. There is also considerable cross-ownership between countries, which makes things even more opaque. Yet, the fact remains that European households, or at any rate, those that own anything at all, bear in mind that wealth is still very concentrated, with 60% of the total owned by the wealthiest 10%, own the equivalent of all that there is to own in Europe, including its public debt. Under such conditions, how can public debt be reduced to zero? One solution would be to privatize all public assets. According to the national accounts of the various European countries, the proceeds from selling all public buildings, schools, universities, hospitals, police stations, infrastructure, and so on, would be roughly sufficient to pay off all outstanding public debt. Instead of holding public debt via their financial investments, the wealthiest European households would become the direct owners of schools, hospitals, police stations, and so on. Everyone else would then have to pay rent to use these assets and continue to produce the associated public services. This solution, which some very serious people actually advocate, should, to my mind, be dismissed out of hand. If the European social state is to fulfill its mission adequately and durably, especially in the areas of education, health, and security, it must continue to own the related public assets. It is nevertheless important to understand that as things now stand, governments must pay heavy interest, rather than rent, on their outstanding public debt. So the situation is not all that different from paying rent to use the same assets, since these interest payments weigh just as heavily on the public exchequer. A much more satisfactory way of reducing the public debt is to levy an exceptional tax on private capital. For example, a flat tax of 15% on private wealth would yield nearly a year's worth of national income, and thus allow for immediate reimbursement of all outstanding public debt. The state would continue to own its public assets, but its debt would be reduced to zero after 5 years, and it would therefore have no interest to pay. This solution is equivalent to a total repudiation of the public debt, except for two essential differences. First, it is always very difficult to predict the ultimate incidence of a debt repudiation, even a partial one. That is, it is difficult to know who will actually bear the cost. Complete or partial default on the public debt is sometimes tried in situations of extreme over-indebtedness, as in Greece in 2011 to 2012. Bond holders are forced to accept a haircut, as the jargon has it. The value of government bonds held by banks and other creditors is reduced by 10 to 20%, or perhaps even more. The problem is that if one applies a measure of this sort on a large scale, for example, all of Europe and not just Greece, which accounts for just 2% of European GDP, it is likely to trigger a banking panic and a wave of bankruptcies. Depending on which banks are holding various types of bonds, as well as on the structure of their balance sheets, the identity of their creditors, the households that have invested their savings in these various institutions, the nature of those investments, and so on, one can end up with quite different final incidences, which cannot be accurately predicted in advance. Furthermore, it is quite possible that the people with the largest portfolios will be able to restructure their investments in time to avoid the haircut almost entirely. People sometimes think that imposing a haircut is a way of penalizing those investors who have taken the largest risks. Nothing could be further from the truth. Financial assets are constantly being traded, and there is no guarantee that the people who would be penalized in the end are the ones who ought to be. The advantage of an exceptional tax on capital, which is similar to a haircut, is precisely that it would arrange things in a more civilized manner. Everyone would be required to contribute, and, equally important, bank failures would be avoided, since it is the ultimate owners of wealth, physical individuals, who would have to pay, not financial institutions. If such a tax were to be levied, however, the tax authorities would of course need to be permanently and automatically apprised of any bank accounts, stocks, bonds, and other financial assets held by the citizens under their jurisdiction. Without such a financial cadastre, every policy choice would be risky. But the main advantage of a fiscal solution is that the contribution demanded of each individual can be adjusted to the size of his fortune. It would not make much sense to levy an exceptional tax of 15% on all private wealth in Europe. It would be better to apply a progressive tax designed to spare the more modest fortunes and require more of the largest ones. In some respects, this is what European banking law already does, since it generally guarantees deposits up to 100,000 euros in case of bank failure. The progressive capital tax is a generalization of this logic, since it allows much finer gradations of required levies. One can imagine a number of different brackets. Full deposit guarantee up to 100,000 euros, partial guarantee between 100,000 and 500,000 euros, and so on, with as many brackets as seem useful. The progressive tax would also apply to all assets, including listed and unlisted shares, not just bank deposits. This is essential if one really wants to reach the wealthiest individuals, who rarely keep their money in checking accounts. In any event, it would no doubt be too much to try to reduce public debt to zero in one fell swoop. To take a more realistic example, assume that we want to reduce European government debt by around 20% of GDP, which would bring debt levels down from the current 90% of GDP to 70%, not far from the maximum of 60% set by current European treaties. As noted in the previous chapter, a progressive tax on capital at a rate of 0% on fortunes up to 1 million euros, 1% on fortunes between 1 and 5 million euros, and 2% on fortunes larger than 5 million euros would bring in the equivalent of about 2% of European GDP. To obtain one-time receipts of 20% of GDP, it would therefore suffice to apply a special levy with rates 10 times as high, 0% up to 1 million, 10% between 1 and 5 million, and 20% above 5 million. It is interesting to note that the exceptional tax on capital that France applied in 1945 in order to substantially reduce its public debt had progressive rates that ranged from 0 to 25%. One could obtain the same result by applying a progressive tax with rates of 0, 1, and 2% for a period of 10 years. And earmarking the receipts for debt reduction. For example, one could set up a redemption fund similar to the one proposed in 2011 by a council of economists appointed by the German government. This proposal, which was intended to mutualize all Eurozone public debt above 60% of GDP, and especially the debt of Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, and then to reduce the fund gradually to zero, is far from perfect. In particular, it lacks the democratic governance without which the mutualization of European debt is not feasible. But it is a concrete plan that could easily be combined with an exceptional one-time or special 10-year tax on capital. Does inflation redistribute wealth? To recapitulate the argument thus far, I observed that an exceptional tax on capital is the best way to reduce a large public debt. This is by far the most transparent, just, and efficient method. Inflation is another possible option, however. Concretely, since a government bond is a nominal asset, that is, an asset whose price is set in advance and does not depend on inflation, rather than a real asset, whose price evolves in response to the economic situation, generally increasing at least as fast as inflation, as in the case of real estate and shares of stock, a small increase in the inflation rate is enough to significantly reduce the real value of the public debt. With an inflation rate of 5% a year, rather than 2%, the real value of the public debt, expressed as a percentage of GDP, would be reduced by more than 15%, all other things equal, a considerable amount. Such a solution is extremely tempting. Historically, this is how most large public debts were reduced, particularly in Europe in the 20th century. For example, inflation in France and Germany averaged 13 and 17% a year, respectively, from 1913 to 1950. It was inflation that allowed both countries to embark on reconstruction efforts in the 1950s, with a very small burden of public debt. Germany in particular is by far the country that has used inflation most freely, along with outright debt repudiation, to eliminate public debt throughout its history. Apart from the ECB, which is by far the most averse to this solution, It is no accident that all the other major central banks, the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of England, are currently trying to raise their inflation targets more or less explicitly, and are also experimenting with various so-called unconventional monetary policies. If they succeed, say by increasing inflation from 2 to 5% a year, which is by no means assured, these countries will emerge from the debt crisis much more rapidly than the countries of the Eurozone, whose economic prospects are clouded by the absence of any obvious way out, as well as by their lack of clarity concerning the long-term future of budgetary and fiscal union in Europe. Indeed, it is important to understand that without an exceptional tax on capital and without additional inflation, it may take several decades to get out from under a burden of public debt as large as that which currently exists in Europe. To take an extreme case, suppose that inflation is zero and GDP grows at 2% a year, which is by no means assured in Europe today because of the obvious contractionary effect of budgetary rigor, at least in the short term, with a budget deficit limited to 1% of GDP, which in practice implies a substantial primary surplus given the interest on the debt. Then by definition, it would take 20 years to reduce the debt-to-GDP ratio by 20 points. If growth were to fall below 2% in some years, and debt were to rise above 1%, it could easily take 30 or 40 years. It takes decades to accumulate capital. It can also take a very long time to reduce a debt. The most interesting historical example of a prolonged austerity cure can be found in 19th century Britain. As noted in Chapter 3, it would have taken a century of primary surpluses of 2 to 3 points of GDP from 1815 to 1914 to rid the country of the enormous public debt left over from the Napoleonic Wars. Over the course of this period, British taxpayers spent more on interest on the debt than on education. The choice to do so was no doubt in the interest of government bondholders, but unlikely to have been in the general interest of the British people. It may be that the setback to British education was responsible for the country's decline in the decades that followed. To be sure, the debt was then above 200% of GDP, and not barely 100%, as is the case today. And inflation in the 19th century was close to zero, whereas an inflation target of 2% is generally accepted nowadays. Hence, there is hope that European austerity might last only 10 or 20 years, at a minimum, rather than a century. Still, that would be quite a long time. It is reasonable to think that Europe might find better ways to prepare for the economic challenges of the 21st century than to spend several points of GDP a year servicing its debt, at a time when most European countries spend less than 1 point of GDP a year on their universities. That said, I want to insist on the fact that inflation is at best a very imperfect substitute for a progressive tax on capital and can have some undesirable secondary effects. The first problem is that inflation is hard to control. Once it gets started, there is no guarantee that it can be stopped at 5% a year. In an inflationary spiral, everyone wants to make sure that the wages he receives and the prices he must pay evolve in a way that suits him. Such a spiral can be hard to stop. In France, the inflation rate exceeded 50% for 4 consecutive years, from 1945 to 1948. This reduced the public debt to virtually nothing in a far more radical way than the exceptional tax on capital that was collected in 1945. But millions of small savers were wiped out, and this aggravated the persistent problem of poverty among the elderly in the 1950s. In Germany, prices were multiplied by a factor of 100 million between the beginning of 1923 and the end. Germany's society and economy were permanently traumatized by this episode, which undoubtedly continues to influence German perceptions of inflation. The second difficulty with inflation is that much of the desired effect disappears once it becomes permanent and embedded in expectations. In particular, anyone willing to lend to the government will demand a higher rate of interest. To be sure, one argument in favor of inflation remains. Compared with a capital tax, which, like any other tax, inevitably deprives people of resources they would have spent usefully for consumption or investment, inflation, at least in its idealized form, primarily penalizes people who do not know what to do with their money, namely, those who have kept too much cash in their bank account or stuffed into their mattress. It spares those who have already spent everything or invested everything in real economic assets, real estate or business capital, and better still, it spares those who are in debt. Inflation reduces nominal debt, which enables the indebted to get back on their feet more quickly and make new investments. In this idealized version, inflation is in a way a tax on idle capital and an encouragement to dynamic capital. There is some truth to this view, and it should not be dismissed out of hand. But as I showed in examining unequal returns on capital as a function of the initial stake, inflation in no way prevents large and well-diversified portfolios from earning a good return simply by virtue of their size, and without any personal effort by the owner. In the end, the truth is that inflation is a relatively crude and imprecise tool. Sometimes it redistributes wealth in the right direction, sometimes not. To be sure, if the choice is between a little more inflation and a little more austerity, inflation is no doubt preferable. But in France, one sometimes hears the view that inflation is a nearly ideal tool for redistributing wealth, a way of taking money from German rentiers and forcing the aging population on the other side of the Rhine to show more solidarity with the rest of Europe. This is naive and preposterous. In practice, a great wave of inflation in Europe would have all sorts of unintended consequences for the redistribution of wealth and would be particularly harmful to people of modest means in France, Germany, and elsewhere. Conversely, those with fortunes in real estate and the stock market would largely be spared on both sides of the Rhine and everywhere else as well. When it comes to decreasing inequalities of wealth for good or reducing unusually high levels of public debt, a progressive tax on capital is generally a better tool than inflation. What do central banks do? In order to gain a better understanding of the role of inflation, and more generally of central banks in the regulation and redistribution of capital, it is useful to take a step back from the current crisis and to examine these issues in broader historical perspective. Back when the gold standard was the norm everywhere, before World War I, central banks played a much smaller role than they do today. In particular, their power to create money was severely limited by the existing stock of gold and silver. One obvious problem with the gold standard was that the evolution of the overall price level depended primarily on the hazards of gold and silver discoveries. If the global stock of gold was static, but global output increased, the price level had to fall, since the same money stock now had to support a larger volume of commercial exchange. In practice, this was a source of considerable difficulty. If large deposits of gold or silver were suddenly discovered, as in Spanish America in the 16th and 17th centuries, or California in the mid-19th century, prices could skyrocket, which created other kinds of problems and brought undeserved windfalls to some. These drawbacks make it highly unlikely that the world will ever return to the gold standard. Keynes referred to gold as a barbarous relic. Once currency ceases to be convertible into precious metals, however, the power of central banks to create money is potentially unlimited and must therefore be strictly regulated. This is the crux of the debate about central bank independence, as well as the source of numerous misunderstandings. Let me quickly retrace the stages of this debate. At the beginning of the Great Depression, the central banks of the industrialized countries adopted an extremely conservative policy. Having only recently abandoned the gold standard, they refused to create the liquidity necessary to save troubled banks, which led to a wave of bankruptcies that seriously aggravated the crisis and pushed the world to the brink of the abyss. it is important to understand the trauma occasioned by this tragic historical experience. Since then, everyone agrees that the primary function of central banking is to ensure the stability of the financial system, which requires central banks to assume the role of lenders of last resort. In case of absolute panic, they must create the liquidity necessary to avoid a broad collapse of the financial system. It is essential to realize that this view has been shared by all observers of the system since the 1930s, regardless of their position on the New Deal or the various forms of social state created in the United States and Europe at the end of World War II. Indeed, faith in the stabilizing role of central banking at times seems inversely proportional to faith in the social and fiscal policies that grew out of the same period. This is particularly clear in the monumental Monetary History of the United States, published in 1963 by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. In this fundamental work, the leading figure in monetary economics follows in minute detail the changes in United States monetary policy from 1857 to 1960, based on voluminous archival records. Unsurprisingly, the focal point of the book is the Great Depression. For Friedman, no doubt is possible. It was the unduly restrictive policy of the Federal Reserve that transformed the stock market crash into a credit crisis and plunged the economy into a deflationary spiral and a depression of unprecedented magnitude. The crisis was primarily monetary, and therefore its solution was also monetary. From this analysis, Friedman drew a clear political conclusion. In order to ensure regular, undisrupted growth in a capitalist economy, it is necessary and sufficient to make sure that monetary policy is designed to ensure steady growth of the money supply. Accordingly, monetarist doctrine held that the New Deal, which created a large number of government jobs and social transfer programs, was a costly and useless sham. Saving capitalism did not require a welfare state or a tentacular government. The only thing necessary was a well-run Federal Reserve. In the 1960s to 1970s, although many Democrats in the United States still dreamed of completing the New Deal, the U.S. public had begun to worry about their country's decline relative to Europe, which was then still in a phase of rapid growth. In this political climate, Friedman's simple but powerful political message had the effect of a bombshell. The work of Friedman and other Chicago School economists fostered suspicion of the ever-expanding state and created the intellectual climate in which the conservative revolution of 1979 to 1980 became possible. One can obviously reinterpret these events in a different light. There is no reason why a properly functioning Federal Reserve cannot function as a complement to a properly functioning social state and a well-designed progressive tax policy. These institutions are clearly complements rather than substitutes. Contrary to monetarist doctrine, the fact that the Fed followed an unduly restrictive monetary policy in the early 1930s, as did the central banks of the other rich countries, says nothing about the virtues and limitations of other institutions. That is not the point that interests me here, however. The fact is that all economists, monetarists, Keynesians, and neoclassicals, together with all other observers, regardless of their political stripe, have agreed that central banks ought to act as lenders of last resort and do whatever is necessary to avoid financial collapse and a deflationary spiral. This broad consensus explains why all of the world's central banks, in Japan and Europe, as well as the United States, reacted to the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 by taking on the role of lenders of last resort and stabilizers of the financial system. Apart from the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008, bank failures in the crisis have been fairly limited in scope. There is, however, no consensus as to the exact nature of the unconventional monetary policies that should be followed in situations like this. What, in fact, do central banks do? For present purposes, it is important to realize that central banks do not create wealth as such. they redistribute it. More precisely, when the Fed or the ECB decides to create a billion additional dollars or euros, U.S. or European capital is not augmented by that amount. In fact, national capital does not change by a single dollar or euro, because the operations in which central banks engage are always loans. They therefore result in the creation of financial assets and liabilities, which, at the moment they are created, exactly balance each other. For example, the Fed might lend $1 billion to Lehman Brothers, or General Motors, or the U.S. government, and these entities contract an equivalent debt. The net wealth of the Fed and Lehman Brothers, or General Motors, does not change at all, nor, a fortiori, does that of the United States, or the planet. Indeed, it would be astonishing if central banks could simply, by the stroke of a pen, increase the capital of their nation, or the world. What happens next depends on how this monetary policy influences the real economy. If the loan initiated by the central bank enables the recipient to escape from a bad pass and avoid a final collapse, which might decrease the national wealth, then, when the situation has been stabilized and the loan repaid, it makes sense to think that the loan from the Fed increased the national wealth, or at any rate prevented national wealth from decreasing. On the other hand, if the loan from the Fed merely postpones the recipient's inevitable collapse, and even prevents the emergence of a viable competitor, which can happen, one can argue that the Fed's policy ultimately decreased the nation's wealth. Both outcomes are possible, and every monetary policy raises both possibilities to one degree or another. To the extent that the world's central banks limited the damage from the recession of 2008 to 2009, they helped to increase GDP and investment, and therefore augmented the capital of the wealthy countries and of the world. Obviously, however, a dynamic evaluation of this kind is always uncertain and open to challenge. What is certain is that when central banks increase the money supply by lending to a financial or non-financial corporation or a government, there is no immediate impact on national capital, both public and private. What unconventional monetary policies have been tried since the crisis of 2007 to 2008? In calm periods, central banks are content to ensure that the money supply grows at the same pace as economic activity in order to guarantee a low inflation rate of 1 or 2% a year. Specifically, they create new money by lending to banks for very short periods, often no more than a few days. These loans guarantee the solvency of the entire financial system. Households and firms deposit and withdraw vast sums of money every day, and these deposits and withdrawals are never perfectly balanced for any particular bank. The major innovation since 2008 has been in the duration of loans to private banks. Instead of lending for a few days, the Fed and ECB began lending for 3 to 6 months. The volume of loans of these durations increased dramatically in the last quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009. They also began lending at similar durations to non-financial corporations. In the United States especially, the Fed also made loans of 9 to 12 months to the banking sector and purchased long-dated bonds outright. In 2011 to 2012, the central banks again expanded the range of their interventions. The Fed, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of England had been buying sovereign debt since the beginning of the crisis, but as the debt crisis worsened in southern Europe, the ECB decided to follow suit. These policies call for several clarifications. First, the central banks have the power to prevent a bank or non-financial corporation from failing by lending it the money needed to pay its workers and suppliers, but they cannot oblige companies to invest or households to consume, and they cannot compel the economy to resume its growth. Nor do they have the power to set the rate of inflation. The liquidity created by the central banks probably warded off deflation and depression, but the economic outlook in the wealthy countries remains gloomy, especially in Europe, where the crisis of the euro has undermined confidence. The fact that governments in the wealthiest countries, United States, Japan, Germany, France, and Britain, could borrow at exceptionally low rates, just over 1%, in 2012 to 2013, attests to the importance of central bank stabilization policies. But it also shows that private investors have no clear idea of what to do with the money lent by the monetary authorities at rates close to zero. Hence, they prefer to lend their cash back to the governments deemed the most solid at ridiculously low interest rates. The fact that rates are very low in some countries and much higher in others is the sign of an abnormal economic situation. Central banks are powerful because they can redistribute wealth very quickly, and in theory, as extensively as they wish. If necessary, a central bank can create as many billions as it wants in seconds and credit all that cash to the account of a company or government in need. In an emergency, such as a financial panic, war, or natural disaster, this ability to create money immediately in unlimited amounts is an invaluable attribute. No tax authority can move that quickly to levy a tax. It is necessary first to establish a taxable base, set rates, pass a law, collect the tax, forestall possible challenges, and so on. If this were the only way to resolve a financial crisis, all the banks in the world would already be bankrupt. Rapid execution is the principal strength of the monetary authorities. The weakness of central banks is clearly their limited ability to decide who should receive loans in what amount and for what duration, as well as the difficulty of managing the resulting financial portfolio. One consequence of this is that the size of a central bank's balance sheet should not exceed certain limits. With all the new types of loans and financial market interventions that have been introduced since 2008, central bank balance sheets have roughly doubled in size. The sum of the Federal Reserve's assets and liabilities has gone from 10 to more than 20% of GDP. The same is true of the Bank of England. And the ECB's balance sheet has expanded from 15 to 30% of GDP. These are striking developments, but these sums are still fairly modest compared with total net private wealth, which is 500 to 600% of GDP in most of the rich countries. It is, of course, possible in the abstract to imagine much larger central bank balance sheets. The central banks could decide to buy up all of a country's firms and real estate, finance the transition to renewable energy, invest in universities, and take control of the entire economy. Clearly, the problem is that central banks are not well suited to such activities and lack the democratic legitimacy to try them. They can redistribute wealth quickly and massively, but they can also be very wrong in their choice of targets, just as the effects of inflation on inequality can be quite perverse. Hence, it is preferable to limit the size of central bank balance sheets. That is why they operate under strict mandates, focused largely on maintaining the stability of the financial system. In practice, when a government decides to aid a particular branch of industry, as the United States did with General Motors in 2009 to 2010, it was the federal government and not the Federal Reserve that took charge of making loans, acquiring shares, and setting conditions and performance objectives. The same is true in Europe. Industrial and educational policy are matters for states to decide, not central banks. The problem is not one of technical impossibility, but of democratic governance. The fact that it takes time to pass tax and spending legislation is not an accident. When significant shares of national wealth are shifted about, it is best not to make mistakes. Among the many controversies concerning limiting the role of central banks, two issues are of particular interest here. One has to do with the complementary nature of bank regulation and taxation of capital, as the recent crisis in Cyprus made quite clear. The other has to do with the increasingly apparent deficiencies of Europe's current institutional architecture. The European Union is engaged in a historically unprecedented experiment, attempting to create a currency on a very large scale without a state. The Cyprus crisis, when the capital tax and banking regulation come together. The primary and indispensable role of central banking is to ensure the stability of the financial system. Central banks are uniquely equipped to evaluate the position of the various banks that make up the system and can refinance them if necessary in order to ensure that the payment system functions normally. They are sometimes assisted by other authorities specifically charged with regulating the banks. For example, by issuing banking licenses and ensuring that certain financial ratios are maintained, in order to make sure that the banks keep sufficient reserves of cash and safe assets relative to loans and other assets deemed to be higher risk. In all countries, the central banks and bank regulators, who are often affiliated with the central banks, work together. In current discussions concerning the creation of a European banking union, the ECB is supposed to play the central role. In particularly severe banking crises, central banks also work in concert with international organizations such as the IMF. Since 2009 to 2010, a troika consisting of the European Commission, the ECB, and the IMF has been working to resolve the financial crisis in Europe, which involves both a public debt crisis and a banking crisis, especially in southern Europe. The recession of 2008 to 2009 caused a sharp rise in the public debt of many countries that were already heavily indebted before the crisis, especially Greece and Italy, and also led to a rapid deterioration of bank balance sheets, especially in countries affected by a collapsing real estate bubble, most notably Spain. In the end, the two crises are inextricably linked. The banks are holding government bonds, whose precise value is unknown. Greek bonds were subjected to a substantial haircut, and although the authorities have promised not to repeat this strategy elsewhere, the fact remains that future actions are unpredictable in such circumstances. State finances can only continue to get worse as long as the economic outlook continues to be bleak, as it probably will as long as the financial and credit system remains largely blocked. One problem is that neither the Troika nor the various member state governments have automatic access to international banking data, or what I have called a financial cadastre, which would allow them to distribute the burdens of adjustment in an efficient and transparent manner. I have already discussed the difficulties that Italy and Spain faced in attempting to impose a progressive tax on capital on their own in order to restore their public finances to a sound footing. The Greek case is even more extreme. Everyone is insisting that Greece collect more taxes from its wealthier citizens. This is no doubt an excellent idea. The problem is that in the absence of adequate international cooperation, Greece obviously has no way to levy a just and efficient tax on its own, since the wealthiest Greeks can easily move their money abroad, often to other European countries. The European and international authorities have never taken steps to implement the necessary laws and regulations, however. Lacking tax revenues, Greece has therefore been obliged to sell public assets, often at fire sale prices, to buyers of Greek or other European nationalities, who evidently would rather take advantage of such an opportunity than pay taxes to the Greek government. The March 2013 crisis in Cyprus